Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO, and welcome to episode number 13 with Dr. Bruce Maccabee. He's a very interesting guest. He spent a long career at the Naval Surface Warfare Center. During the time, since the 1960s, he was doing UFO research, but one had nothing to do with the other. He does excellent photo and film analysis. Your feedback is always welcome. You can email us at info@podcastufo.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/auctionpodcast. And I hope you enjoy today's show. Hi, everyone. I have Dr. Bruce Maccabee on the line. How are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And I've seen you in a number of videos and have looked online, and you have quite a background. Can you tell our listening audience basically your background?
Well, I graduated from high school, of course, and I went through 10 years of college to get a PhD in physics from American University in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I went to work for the Navy in January of 1972 and stayed there until 2008, 36 years.
Wow. That's a long run.
Navy experience, yeah, I had no idea that was going to happen. When I started off, I thought I'd work for the Navy for a few years and then work for a company or something. But anyway, of course, I did a lot of different research projects for the Navy. But in the meantime, in the late 60s, while I was getting my PhD, I got interested in the UFO phenomenon and went on some case investigations with some other people in the late 60s, early 70s, and then, you might say, struck out on my own in the 70s and 80s, 90s, and even up until today, for example. So I've got experience in interviewing people and creating the history of a sighting and analysis. I try to do scientific analysis as much as possible. Mm-hmm. You have to have a lot of scientific background of various types in order to handle the UFO subject anyway. Things like astronomy can be very important, knowing stars and planets and what's up in the sky and stuff like that.
So you left the Navy in 2008, so you were doing both. Was there ever a conflict at all?
No. The Navy people told me to just leave their name out of it, and they didn't care what I did on my own time.
Wow. That's almost surprising, but that's great they let you do that. I know analysis is a big part of that. Can you explain, and just before we go on with that question, I think I heard you say in a video one time or maybe at a conference that photos don't really matter as much as the witnesses to corroborate the photo. So can you kind of explain what you meant by that and what's involved in doing analysis on a typical photo?
Well, what I said was the photo a UFO does not make. You got to have a lot of circumstantial evidence to support the photo. Now, a photo can break a case. There might be some evidence in it that is clearly showing it's a hoax, a little thin line coming down to the top of a UFO or some sort of support at the bottom or something like that. But if you find no evidence of faking, you could say, well, that's a perfect fake. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
I learned this the hard way, you might say, from my study of the Trent photos, the McMinnville photo, McMinnville, Oregon, May 11th, 1950. Two photographs taken by a farmer.
Oh, yes.
His wife saw this thing.
That's right. It's right by right by a building, right?
Well, you see the garage, part of the garage in the picture. You see a couple of wires going over the top. You see this two pictures showing different orientations of this object. And the pictures are clear enough. You don't need magnifying glass to see what the image shape is. And it's clearly the real thing or a hoax. There's no halfway point. So this illustrates the situation. Lots of laboratories have looked at this for the original negatives and tried to find proof, evidence of a hoax, and haven't found it. But, yeah, they could have been lucky, mm-hmm. or they could have been clever.
Hmm.
If you consider the problem of a string, for example, it has to be a certain thickness. Anything that's too thin would be silhouetted against the background grayish sky. This is a black and white photograph, so the background sky just looks, you know, light colored. If they had been clever and had taken a thread that matched the color of the background, then you'd never see it at all.
Hmm.
Because you've got to have contrast in order to see something.
Right, right.
And so then I did a lot of study on that particular case in the middle 70s, because it was the only one that was sort of endorsed by the photographic analyst, Dr. William Hartman, who was working for the Condon Committee as part of what was called the Scientific Study of Unidentified Flying Objects, carried out at the University of Colorado in 68, 69 mm-hmm. time frame. Hartman had said that he concluded in his summary that all factors investigated seem to point towards the truth of the claim by the witnesses that they saw an extraordinary flying object pass by. In other words, he was convinced that was the only case that he thought was could really be real. As I said, it was either the real thing or a hoax, and he didn't find any evidence he could point to prove it was a hoax. But then some people came along, Clay, and criticized his analysis and so on. Robert Schaefer and Philip J. Class criticized Hartman's analysis, partially on photographic grounds and partially on Hartman wasn't, in a sense, hard enough on the witnesses, I guess you might say. Hmm. Anyway, I spent many years investigating it, both from the point of view of technical details of the photography and the life history of the Trents. And I got testimony from a number of different people who had known the Trents and so on. And the Trents stayed alive up until 1995. I was interacting with them from 1974 approximately to 1980, talking to Mrs. Trent many times.
Mm-hmm.
And they both died in the middle 90s, and they were maintaining their story right up to the end, you might say.
Hmm.
And nobody that I know of found any evidence that they would be likely to even think of a hoax of any type at all. See, nothing about UFO hoax. They were, what we might call simple farmers, and had plenty to keep them busy besides making up a model and hanging on a string, and then for whatever it was worth, which wasn't anything really.
Now,
they didn't make any money out of the whole thing.
Now, there was very similar object. There's photos in different places in the world, isn't that right?
Well, there's only one other case that I know that looks virtually identical. It's just a slightly different orientation, and that's a so-called photo taken supposedly in Rouen, France. By a military, some pilot in a military airplane. That's the way the story appeared in the Royal Air Force Flying Review and Flying Saucer Review, two magazines that were published in England. They both mentioned this photograph. Unfortunately, nobody's been able to track that photo back to its origin.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody did an investigation of it at the time it was published. All we know is that they say it was a photo taken in 1957. And that's the only one that looks, would be almost identical to the Trent photos. There have been, of course, lots of other photos of circular shaped craft.
But this sort of had like a flat top to it, or looks something like a flat top.
Trent one has a pole on the top.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yes, I remember that now.
It's on my website, a big long article on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever take a look at the three or four Polaroid pictures that were taken from the person in the truck? Sorry, I don't have my facts exactly straight.
You're talking about the Heflin case.
That's right, yeah.
65, I think that was. I looked at it, but it's most recently been studied by other people. because when I was looking at it in the 1970s, 80s, all I had were copies.
Mm.
In that situation, Rex Heflin said that a few days after he had his photos, they were published in a newspaper. Some people showed up with the military uniforms on, a black car or whatever, and requested asked if they could borrow the pictures for analysis.
Mm-hmm.
They had already been to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and to the Altoa Marine Base, I believe, or at least to the Altoa Marine Base, and they had been returned. So he gave up these pictures, and they never returned. His original Polaroids
mm-hmm.
were gone.
For a long time, but they came back to someone, right?
They came back in the middle 90s. So the lady called him on the phone and said, "Why don't you go out and check your mailbox?" And sure enough, there was an envelope with his pictures in it.
That is just bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Strange circumstances.
Make this out to be, from that point of view, make it out to be a hoax or the real thing. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But a much more sophisticated analysis has shown that it's quite likely that this is a real case.
Mm-hmm.
Even Fact or Fake has done some stuff on a TV show.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, and their big thing is to make models and try to duplicate the pictures and so on. One of the biggest criticism against the pictures that Heflin took was his last photograph, which doesn't show an object, but it shows a smoke ring,
mm-hmm.
and it shows the sky. And he had said that the smoke ring picture had been taken, I think, within a minute of the disappearance of this object. And he thought the smoke ring had been made by the object. Well, I'm not sure if he was positive about that. But at any rate, he took a picture of the smoke ring, and when he took a picture of the smoke ring, you could see a lot of structure of clouds in the sky. In his three photos of the object itself, you couldn't see any structure in the sky. And so there was a question, did he really take four photos in a short period of time, or was a period of time when he could be creating a hoax smoke ring or something to back up his story about UFO?
Mm.
And that was a sore point for a long time. Why isn't there structure in the sky in the first three pictures if there's structure in the fourth? Turned out the answer was that the camera had automatic exposure control. When it was in the truck, it was not receiving as much light as it was when it was outside the truck to take the he took the first three pictures when he was inside the truck, and the fourth picture when he was outside the truck. So when he was outside the truck, the exposure meter was giving the correct exposure for the sky, presumably, and then you could see structure. Whereas when he was inside the truck, the exposure meter wasn't getting enough light, so it was opening up the lens more or allowing a longer time of exposure, exposing the film more, and that tended to lose contrast. The sky structure was too bright to be accurately photographed.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out that with this more recent analysis, that argument was verified, and so now nobody can claim that Heflin took three photos of a model and then took minutes or hours later took a photo of a ring. They can argue that he took these four photos within a matter of minutes at the most.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Now, I know you did a bit of work on the Phoenix Lights. Can you talk about that?
Well, a year after the Phoenix Lights case occurred, and you're talking about March 13, 1997.
Right. Uh-huh.
I might point out that there have been, quote, Phoenix Lights, unquote, for many times before that, in the previous months and years,
mm-hmm.
many times since then. And
April. All in that Phoenix Valley right there?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people in the Phoenix area and west and the north and so on of the city of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, in April of 1998, I was asked by one of the video witnesses, Lynn Katai, to evaluate her videos and the other videos from March 13th and also from other years, which I had not heard about at that time when she contacted me. She told me about January of 1998 and some other dates at which there had been lights. She said they looked exactly the same as they saw on March 13th. Hmm. And so she sent me a bunch of videotapes, and I started an analysis. And I was, for various other reasons, able to get to the Phoenix area and actually go to the locations where the videos were taken, take background or scenery videos, you might say, to in order to carry out what's known as a triangulation. From mm-hmm. each point, from each location of a video camera, I would project the sighting line off into the distance and then see if, from two locations, if the sighting lines would meet somewhere, then that would imply that the object was, the lights were where the sighting lines met. And I did this for the famous Kristen arc that everybody ever sees on TV and so on. They show over and over again, an arc of mm-hmm. lights, taken by Mike Kristen. And Lynn Katai had a video that showed three lights. And Charles Raridan, who was about 30 miles east of Lynn Katai, also saw the same Kristen arc, but he saw it from a slightly different perspective. And I was able to demonstrate that if you took Kristen's sighting line and projected it, and Chuck Raridan's sighting line and projected it, the lights were 50 or 60 miles or 70 to 80 miles southwest of Phoenix. The witnesses had all said that the lights were over Phoenix and that they never moved. Now, I'm talking about lights that were taken that were videotaped at 10 o'clock at night. There's the sightings at 8:30, well, we say between 8 and 9 p.m., and in particular around 8:30 when some object appears to have traveled over Phoenix. That's an independent, not what I'm talking about. I was asked to analyze videos that were taken, and the videos on March 13th were taken at around 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I found by careful analysis of the images of the videos that these lights were actually dropping downwards and moving a bit to the left. The sighting line was to the south or southwest. And I learned from a meteorologist that the general air mass was moving from west towards the east. If you're looking south and you see something moving from west to east, then it's moving from right to left in front of in your field of view. And that's what these lights do. They drop downwards and move to the left at a rate that's not compatible with the idea that they were flares, very bright LUU-2 military illumination flares, which are dropped and then they deploy a parachute, and heat from the flare keeps the parachute aloft for a long time,
mm-hmm.
or makes it drop very slowly, I should say. So anyway, that was my input to the Phoenix light situation, was to show the videos taken at 10 o'clock probably were not related to the whatever it was that flew over Phoenix at 8:30. But unfortunately, there's supposedly one video of that, which is not very good. Mostly it was just witnesses seeing that thing go over.
Yeah, and there were enough of them.
No, there were. When I began my investigation of the so-called Phoenix lights, the videos,
mm-hmm.
I began by analyzing not the March 13th, 1997, but videos taken by the same witnesses on January 14th, 1998. In January 14th, 1998, they had a line of, the videos show a line of lights, almost not exactly equal, but pretty close to equal spacing. And if you set a ruler on your TV screen while you play this video and look at the line of lights, it's perfectly straight, which we were told is impossible to do.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. But when you plot the triangle, the line of lights from different perspectives, it turns out that there's a curvature. Hmm. You can't see from just one perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I analyzed lights from January 14, 1998, and concluded that they too were 70 or so miles southwest of Phoenix. Now, what is southwest of Phoenix? The Barry Goldwater Training Range,
mm-hmm.
where the military drops flares as part of military exercises. And we were told in June of 1997 that the Maryland National Guard had been using the Barry Goldwater Training Range to drop flares at high altitude. So this is all stuff that's on my website for people who are interested in knowing what is known about those videos.
Mm-hmm. Well, while you just mentioned that, why don't you give out your website address?
Okay, that's www.brumac, that's brumac.8k.com. Brumac.8k.com.
All right, and I'll put that under this podcast as well. Can you think of a situation where there was looked like pretty solid evidence for a long time and you figured out that it was a hoax?
Well, yeah. There was August 6th, 1996, I think, video from Mexico City, which looked very good as a... Anybody who's seen that video a number of times would recognize it from the description. You see a building off in the distance, a big
yes.
high-rise apartment building.
And the thing's kind
at
of floating.
At the left edge of this building, you see this circular thing rotating and wobbling.
Right.
And then it starts to move towards the building. It disappears for a period of time behind the building, supposedly, then reappears up above the building, travels along to the right. It's always moving to the right, travels to the right, and then shrinks and disappears, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty interesting. I thought there might be some physics related to the propulsion of this object based on the wobbling and rotation. But there was another guy who was also working on this case, Jeffrey Sanio, MUFON photo analyst. And he had discovered something funny that he did it on a statistical basis by analyzing each frame of the video. And turned out that as the camera wobble occurred, the camera that was taking the video supposedly was looking at this scene from another apartment house or an office building, and it was being held by hand. It was wobbling around. And he found that on a statistical basis, the edge of the building would get smeared by the hand of the vibration, but the edges of the UFO did not.
Mm.
And then I found two frames that I have posted on my website, two frames that clearly show what I call fingerprints of a hoax, where the camera moved enough. We know that the buildings do not move. I mean, that's sort of a fundamental assumption here. And yet, the edges of the building are so smeared in the vertical direction, the horizontal edge is so smeared. I should say the horizontal edge of the top of the building is so smeared by vertical motion that it's hard to make out where the edge is. And there are little flags, or I was told they were wind socks, on the top of the building. You can see it in the steady frames, but this couple of really super blurred frames, the blurring is so much that you can't even see the windsock. It's just blurred out, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
But the edge of the UFO doesn't change. It's just as sharp as the frames where there's no blurring.
Mm.
There's two frames for comparison here where the building edge is extremely blurred. The UFO edge is not. And this sounds to me like the UFO image was pasted in.
Hmm. That seems like that would be very difficult to do, but obviously with all the software and stuff out there, people
when that video came out, I was interacting with a guy in Hollywood who was making TV shows and stuff, and he had some people. He told me he had some people say, okay, if you're going to do this yourself, what are you going to do? I got several video from different people who took on the problem of creating a video that looked like that. Hmm. And none of them looked exactly the same, but they all had the same characteristics of an object rotating and wobbling and then going behind a building and coming up above and then going off into the distance.
Wow.
And apparently for somebody who was really into CGI, computer-generated imagery, mm-hmm. it was not a very difficult task. Mm. And one big problem has to go with the circumstantial evidence. Unlike the Mendenhall case, where you had the people that were the witnesses and the photographer available to talk to for years and years afterwards, in this Mexico City case, it was the video was sent to Jamie Mossan, who was a TV commentator there, who's done a lot of work on UFOs, and it was anonymous. The person said that he was in the country illegally and didn't want to reveal his name. But with an anonymous witness, there's not much you can do. So the video sort of hangs out there in free space, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Except for that problem with the smear of the buildings being greater than the smear of the UFO image itself. And by the way, both smears should be the same. Right. If it's a real image, if it's a real thing out there.
Mm-hmm.
Except for that, this would have been treated as a monumental UFO video. But fortunately, Sanio discovered this problem with it before everybody went super public and committed themselves to say, well, it's real. Tons of videos, of course, on the Internet in the years since. And I don't know how many million there might be now.
Yeah.
But various levels of detail and quality.
I know the one that has the most hits on it on YouTube is the one that was proven to be a hoax, and that's the one in Haiti. That was totally a hoax. Very, very well done. I mean, these people are very, the people that really go through all the trouble seem to do a pretty good job for the most part.
That was a video?
Yes, it was a video in Haiti, and there was an analysis of it. And I think there's something like 16 million downloads of it. It's something.
Probably saw it, but I've seen so many they just sort of blur together.
Yeah. Now, have you looked into the one that looked really good for a while? And I haven't really heard anything about it, but it was the Dome of Israel. Have you looked into that one?
Yeah, well, there are a number of commentaries on that. That's where this the video shows a bright light dropping down towards mm-hmm. the Dome of the Rock. And it sits there, and all of a sudden there's a very bright flash, and then it goes zooming up. And supposedly some of the witnesses saw red lights up in the sky, I think, as they looked up after the thing zoomed away, whatever. And there were, I think, four videos associated with that.
That's right.
And one of them, the second or third to come out, was absolutely and concretely proven to be a hoax.
Really?
There's no doubt about it, because it was a photograph of the scene that was used for the camera shake to make it look as if the camera was photographing the scene. But as time went on, as I recall, the lights in the scene never changed.
Hmm.
Like the UFO imagery was superimposed on. Like they had taken a photograph and used that as the background, and then they put this UFO into the scene, and then they, after getting the composite, then they started causing it to wiggle around, either by using a video camera to videotape a screen that was showing this video, or they actually use a program to cause the whole scene to shift back and forth, up and down in a random manner.
So
that was one of the videos where it was absolutely proven to be a hoax. And I think I sort of lost interest in it and didn't really track it very closely after that, but I think
basically it's
considered to be a hoax now.
I would think that if one was a hoax and it just kind of gives them all away.
At the very least, it's not something to spend a lot of time on. There was another problem with that was the lack of reaction of city officials, shall we say. I pointed out that when this, others had pointed out that if this thing had actually been a bright light that dropped down into Dublin, Iraq, which has got to be one of the most secure areas in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every other person in the street probably is a Mossad person or a Secret Service or something like that. Keeping track of what, even though it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon, in the evening, 1 o'clock in the morning, I should say, approximately 1 o'clock in the morning, I believe, there would have been tourists and other people there. And this bright light, the big bright flash that occurred, is shown lighting up the buildings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever been in an electrical storm in a house when lightning and thunder are going off, you can be inside the house, and if a lightning flash occurs, you see that inside the house, even if you're not looking out the window.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a flash of light. There's so much light that's lighting up everything, and light goes through windows and lights up rooms and so on. Well, I would have expected that someone would have said, hey, what's that flash of light that we had last night?
Good point. Yeah. Yep.
There was a lack of background. Now, there was a so-called Chad hoax, where some guy by the name of Chad supposedly took a picture of a thing that looked like somewhat like a ceiling fan in the air. He had a number of photos, supposedly, of a novel UFO that had wires going upwards in a curvy manner, like a vase.
I think I've seen that somewhere. That sounds very familiar.
It was 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
First, there was one set of photos from one location in China, California, I think. Then another location, then another location. And the shape of the object, the structure of the object, got more complicated as this went on. Then there was a document, supposedly of a top-secret project to reverse engineer a UFO that came out, and it was also related to this. I think the whole thing ended up being a publicity ploy for somebody trying to demonstrate how well he can make computer-generated imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure on that. But again, that's another thing where we never got to talk to the witnesses.
Right. Can you think of a situation where you think it's very solid? You know, I know it must be hard to commit and say, this does not appear to be a hoax. You can't really go much further than that, can you?
Well, you can say if it's got obvious characteristics, that you might be able to say, well, it doesn't look like anything that was made here.
Mm-hmm.
They could take the Trent photographs. It's obviously not a bird or a plane or Superman. And so then what is it? If it's not a hoax, it's a real thing, whatever the real thing is.
Mm-hmm. Which...
Another case that I worked on many years ago was a New Zealand sighting from an airplane. That occurred on December 31st, 1978.
Mm-hmm.
And that investigation lasted days, months, and years.
Really?
But ultimately ended up proving that whatever that was video, that was photographs, I should say, movie film. Now, that case was one of my best documented cases ever, with multiple witnesses, including an airplane crew, captain and co-pilot, and a news crew that was on board the radio on the airplane, a reporter, a cameraman, and a sound recordist. The cameraman got color movie film. There was ground radar and airplane radar involved. So you had images captured on film, and you had the Wellington Air Traffic Control Center audio tape, which provided a timeline for everything that happened, and the reporter himself on the airplane had his own tape of things, and these could be reasonably well correlated. So there were a total of 8 witnesses involved in that case, as I recall.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
solid.
It
required a lot of technical analysis, a lot of interviewing and putting together a history of the whole thing and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that was whatever was there was a real UFO,
mm-hmm.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. Now, did you ever look into the Mexico, the Air Force in Mexico when they filmed with infrared cameras? Those
strange you should bring that up.
Okay.
You often see in TV shows that are talking about UFOs, and they're showing one UFO image after another, and so on. And they'll show this video taken by the Mexican Air Force. This is March 2004. It shows clouds going by from right to left, and these very bright lights off in the distance appearing to go behind the clouds and come out, pop from behind the clouds, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear, if you could speak Spanish, you'd know that the guy was talking about seeing these lights out there and thinking they were traveling right along with them, and that they had 12, I think it was, UFOs traveling along with the airplane. Well, yeah, I did a study on it. It's probably the largest study ever published on it. I've never seen anything written up by the Mexican authorities. I know that NARCAP did some work on it, but I don't know if they've ever published a report.
Mm-hmm.
That was a strange case, because what alerted them to pay any attention at all to what was going on was not the infrared, but was radar. Now, if you can imagine the Yucatan Peninsula jutting out to the right, jutting out to the east, Mexico City's off to your left, to the west of the Yucatan, and this airplane is flying along in the southwest, in the northwest direction. And suddenly on their radar, and this is an airplane which can do about 300 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
Or 250 or something like that. It's on daily, I suppose, periodic surveillance for drug runners and contraband aircraft and stuff like that.
Mm.
And they have a camera that in the belly of the airplane that they can use pick up either infrared or visible, imagery. And also they have the radar. Now, the radar tends to point in a downward direction because they're looking for airplanes taking off or landing in forbidden airfields. As they're heading south northwest over the Yucatan, they start picking up this radar target. The first thought was, oh, some airplane has just taken off from a landing zone down there, and we should follow it, I guess. Their assumption was it might be a drug runner. So anyway, they turned their aircraft a little bit to go trail behind this thing, and then they start catching up with it, and they get to within 2 miles of it. They can't seem to get any closer than that. It speeds up, and then it maintains a two-mile distance. So naturally, once they detect it on radar, initially I think about 5 miles, and then they get closer to it, they're looking out the windows thinking, we ought to be able to see this thing. You can see an airplane at 5 miles, you can see an airplane at 4 miles, you can see it at 3, you can even see it at 2 miles. Even better at 2 miles, obviously. So why can't they see it? So they're looking and looking with their visible camera. They're not using the infrared yet. They're using the visible. And they track it for a while. And then they switch to infrared. Now, this is a special type of infrared known as mid-infrared, burning 3 to 5 micron wavelength. That visible light is a 7/10 of a micron or less. And heat that you feel radiating bodies typically is around 10 microns. These are the wavelengths I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the mid-infrared is if you take a photograph with a mid-infrared imager, you can see structures such as what you would see with the naked eye, but you can also see hot places that you could only see with a heat-sensitive camera. So if you're looking with your naked eye, you can see the outline of the aircraft. If you're looking with this mid-infrared, you can see the outline of the aircraft, but you can also see the heat trail. You can see the hot air coming out the back. You can see the hot engines, right?
Mm.
So they start looking with the infrared, and they can't find it there either. They're traveling along for 10 minutes behind this object, and then they start running out of fuel. So they, and unfortunately, there was no ground radar operating at the time. So they were picking it up on their radar, picking it up on their infrared. No, I take that back. They did not pick it up on their infrared. They should have, you would think. But they were scanning with the infrared. They're picking it up on radar. They're not seeing it visually. They're not seeing it on infrared. They didn't know what it was. Could have been a radar anomaly, a radar problem with the radar. Well, and they never had any problems with it before, and they didn't have any problems with it afterwards, I guess. They made a turn to the right to head east after traveling for a distance over the Yucatan Peninsula. Heading northwest, they made a right turn to the east. And they were still tracking this thing on radar. Oddly enough, it sped up. It increased its speed. It was continued its track towards the northwest, whereas the plane was now heading east. It continued on its track northwest at a higher speed and finally disappeared about 40 miles from the airplane, which was the range of the maximum range of their radar. It was going faster when they after they turned away. Now, that sounded a little strange for a typical airplane. So if it was trying to run away from them and it had the capability of doing 300-some miles an hour, which is what it was doing after the surveillance plane turned east, when they were traveling northwest, they were doing 220 or 30 mile knots, I think. And then when the plane turned east, this object sped up and headed off into the distance. Whatever it was, that was the real UFO right there. Nobody pays any attention to. Nobody knows what that was.
It's funny.
But then, as they headed to the east, they're still looking for this object with their infrared, and they suddenly start picking up bright spots off in the distance. And they initially get one or two bright lights off in the distance, and then they get a group of them. And these things appear to be a considerable distance away from the airplane and going behind clouds. But the perspective, the view of these things make it look like they're traveling right along with the airplane. They can't see anything with the naked eye, but they can pick up these bright lights with the video, with the infrared camera. As they travel along to the east, these things, as I said, seem to be traveling along with them. And finally, after 10 or 15 minutes, I forget, these things have dropped back behind or disappear, and they're not seen anymore, and that's basically the end of the sighting. They picked up on radar a few things on the ground, perhaps, and picked up on the infrared, maybe some things on the ground that were hot, but man operating the FLIR says it looks like he's got 12 UFOs traveling along with him. He's looking at something that makes heat, but the question is what? Well, it turned out that a guy in Mexico had realized right off the bat that this airplane, the people in the airplane were looking toward a oil field about 100 miles away, and the Pemco Oil Corporation. And they have these Texas Tower-type things out in the Bay of Water that's above the Yucatan Peninsula, the Gulf of Mexico. So they're, obviously close to the, within 10 or 20 miles of the land, but they're off in the water, Texas Towers, and they're pumping oil and gas out, and they burn the gas off in flames. There's a bunch of these flames going, many of them 24 hours a day. And so the suggestion was made that what these people pick up on their forward-looking infrared, FLIR, was, in fact, these fires at a distance of 110 miles, approximately. And I was contacted by Jane Lausanne and told, asked to do the study of this sort of on the behalf of the Mexican Air Force. They were giving me digital tape, which had everything on it, digital tape copy of the original tape, taped information that was on the airplane. And they gave me the trouble of having everything translated for me and provided me with maps. I got help from other people as well. They analyzed the whole situation and concluded that the radar target was probably a UFO I mean, it certainly was not identifiable, and it did strange things.
Hmm.
It was invisible, but it was picked up continuously on radar. Not the first time radar has picked up things that are not seen.
Hmm.
But very often radar targets, so-called radar angels, are artifacts of the radar itself or the weather problems. But here we have a situation where weather was not playing a role detecting a target at 2 miles away from the airplane. It was maintaining speed and then sped up on its own when it was going away from the aircraft. The aircraft turned away from it. So that was the UFO. Then as my analysis of the lights showed that, in fact, the people were looking, and these lights drifted backwards. As you're looking out to the side and you're traveling along, you point towards an object that's a long distance away, and if you're traveling in a straight line in some direction and you're looking at something at almost 90 degrees to your straight line direction, as you travel along, your pointing direction will drop back towards the rear. And so the pointing direction on these objects actually did drop back a ways, consistent with how they move, how the plane flew along. Bottom line being, they were looking in the direction, they definitely were looking in the direction of these things, the gas flames. And so that was seen to be a reasonable explanation, although I wasn't able to absolutely prove by identifying each flame with each bright light, which is something you should be able to do. But there may not have been enough data to do that. In any case, the Air Force response was, well, we've flown over the area many times and never seen those flares before,
mm-hmm.
the fires. So I don't know, but that's probably explained. The infrared lights are probably not UFOs.
Mm-hmm. But there was one there earlier, which is kind of interesting.
The radar target, I'd say, was an unidentified radar target.
Yeah, really.
Or there wasn't. And you see, the point is, it wasn't a balloon. It was traveling a couple hundred miles an hour. It wasn't an ordinary aircraft, because you would have seen an ordinary aircraft. They couldn't. They
right.
can't paint it invisible. And even somehow they had managed to camouflage an airplane so that you couldn't see it by looking down on it, because it looked like the background. Any engined aircraft we have creates heat. Even the much ballyhooed stealth aircraft would create a heat trail, and certainly not as great as a jet aircraft or something, but you should be able to have seen the engines of any typical aircraft that would be over the Yucatan Peninsula.
Right.
And yet there was nothing there on the FLIR and nothing visible.
Right, yeah.
So what was it?
That's right. That sounds like it was a good one after all, even though the thing that everyone looks at is those lights traveling along.
Well, you know,
yeah.
Press in, garbage out. The press goes to the throat. It's the same sort of thing with the Phoenix Lights. What do they show for Phoenix Lights videos? They show these videos that are probably the flares at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And when they're talking about, they'll be interviewing somebody about what he saw at 8:30. Oh, I saw this big triangular object that went over and had a couple of lights on it because it was as big as a city block.
Mm-hmm.
And while a man is describing that, they'll be showing the Kristen Ark, which has nothing to do with whatever actually went over Phoenix at 8:30.
It makes you wonder if the flares weren't put out there because of the sighting.
Well, I would have to be a quick react situation, of course, because my guess is much more likely that the Maryland National Guard was telling the truth when they said they had. They had access to the Barry Goldwater training range for half an hour or an hour or something like that, up until 10 o'clock at night, and were dropping flares as part of their normal exercises. And if you think about it, there was, on one of those A-10 aircraft, there was 8 flares. And they had a certain number of aircraft and a certain number of flares on all the aircraft that were involved. And apparently they were told that they couldn't land with flares. They had to use them up.
Hmm.
At least that's what the story was. Well, now, if you look at the Kristen Ark, there is a single light that appears, and then 8 more. The arc is actually 8 lights that go off in a row. But there was a single light that had been there for half a minute or a minute before the arc begins. So think about it. If there were 2 airplanes coming back and one of them throws out a flare, that could be a single light. And then one of them dumps in a whole load of 8. Mm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, one after another like that. Then you would get this arc of lights.
So we're just about out of time here, and just one question comes to mind is, what do you think the future is going to be of analysis? I know they can create more and more sophisticated films to fool us, but do you think the analysis will be more sophisticated as well?
Well, the analysis will probably be more sophisticated, but I think it's still going to come down to a lot of the background stuff, the circumstantial evidence, why the film was taken, who took it, how it was taken. You always have to put together a history of the sighting. The problem here in UFOs is UFOs don't exist. Therefore, anything you videotape or photograph is not real. That's from the point of view of conventional science. Mm-hmm. So you've got a tough row to hoe to prove that whatever it is unidentifiable.
Right.
And you prove that the proof can take place by demonstrating that whatever is recorded on the video or film or whatever is clearly not something that would normally be there, whatever it is. And then you've got to prove that whatever the film or video is, isn't a hoax by somebody. Mm-hmm. One of the key things you'll have to have is access to the witnesses, anonymous videos and photos and so on. Don't hack it.
Right.
Yeah. I will say that a single photo or a couple of photos is a lot easier to fake than a movie, film, or a video. Mm. So the fake probability goes down as the complexity goes up.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the fake probability goes to zero. Unless you've got a lot of circumstantial evidence behind it to demonstrate why it should be considered to be the truth as opposed to a hoax.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been really interesting, and I really appreciate your time. So this is Martin Willis with Dr. Bruce McAbee, and that's it for today.